Good morning. Wow. Oh, that was hot. That's good. Well, we're glad you guys are with us for our Christmas experience. That's just fun to say. And what we're going to talk about this morning, in case, obviously, for the month of December, what we've done is kind of talk Christmas themes and ideas and you know, what Christmas is really about, right? Jesus is the reason for the season, you know, the bumper stickers and all that stuff. But what we're going to talk about this morning is something that's really cool to me. I don't know, it's kind of ironic that it's one of those things that we know, but we don't really pay much attention to. You guys ever do that? Like stop signs? Just kidding. Don't do that. But Christmas is just the term Christmas, the word Christmas is actually, it's a compound word. And you put two, you know what a compound word is? You guys remember English, right? It's a subject that you didn't pay any attention in English. You were sleeping. And you had that big red mark on your forehead, because I know how it was, right? And so Christmas is a compound word, and it's the two words are Christ's Mass. And so what the Mass was a service where they would go in and they would celebrate Christ and they would take communion, or you know what they would call the sacrament or the Eucharist. And it's just funny to me that like we don't really think about Christmas like that, right? We think about Christmas as, and sure we think about the birth of Jesus, and but we don't really think about the compound word Christ's Mass, right? Christ's Mass. It's hard to pronounce when you're trying to get that extra S in the apostrophe. Not that you pronounce the apostrophe, but you know what I'm saying, right? And so what we're going to talk about is just talk about that. That's what Christmas really is and kind of what the implications of that are for us today. And we're going to talk about, I think, one of the things that we just kind of lose sight of is that, man, if Jesus didn't come to the earth as the baby, like we celebrate Jesus as the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords, but if he didn't come as a baby, lowly and meek, none of that ever happens, right? Like you got to start somewhere, and that's where he started, as a baby in a manger. And I think kind of speaking, obviously, to the humility of the circumstances that he was in. And so all of that to say, that's what we're going to talk about this morning. And kind of at the end, just so you know, there's no surprises. We're going to take communion as a church because I just can't think of a more fitting way to celebrate what Jesus did for us and kind of the origins of that than by celebrating his life and what it means to us now. And what we're going to do, I've never been excited. I don't think I've ever been more excited in my life to talk about genealogy in church. Like, I mean, how many times do you get geeked up to go home and read the book of First Chronicles, right? Where so-and-so begat so-and-so, and I don't even know what begat means. It means like somebody was getting busy. That's the only thing I can tell you about begatting, right? At any rate, what we're going to talk about is Matthew chapter 1. And this is kind of where it all starts. And what we usually do, we just kind of blur through and blister through verses 1 through 15 and jump right down to verse 16. And this is where we usually start Matthew chapter 1. It's like the rest of it doesn't even matter. And so in verse 16, it says, Jacob was the father of Joseph, the husband of Mary. Mary gave birth to Jesus, who is called the Messiah. And so what we usually do, I mean, what I usually do, you guys are probably more spiritual than I am, so you probably don't do this. We jump right through the first 15 verses to verse 16, and it's like, oh, here we go. This is the important stuff. Mary, the mother of Jesus, who is called the Messiah, and Joseph was her husband. Okay, those are important details. The rest of it doesn't really matter that much. And I think it's just, there's a lot of things. There's some really good and important details in those verses, and it's just names. And you know what names are? They're people. They're people who have stories. And their stories remind us of our story, and their struggles remind us of our struggles. And at the end of the day, it reminds us of our desperate need for Jesus. And all of this genealogy and the people we're going to talk about this morning, it's all just a setup. And it's just a constant reminder of the failure of mankind and humanity, how it's kind of bent on destruction and it's bent to fail. Like, we're not really geared to win. Without Jesus, humans kind of screw things up. We were talking this morning in our leadership meeting about the human condition. Like, I mean, you don't have to tell a two-year-old to be greedy and mean, right? Most of the time, it's like, share now. Where did that come from? You know, it's like spawn of Satan, and I don't know. Like, I mean, it's a human condition. Our tendency is to go towards greed. Our tendency is to go towards pride. Our tendency is to go towards things that we know that we shouldn't. It's our tendency, for whatever reason, is to wander from what we know is right and pulled. Like, there's this gravitational pull to what is wrong. And that's just a reminder that, man, we need Jesus in the baddest way. And that's what this whole story, all this setup, all this genealogy and the lineage of Jesus It's just that. It's a reminder that everybody that was listed, I mean, this is kind of a big deal. Like, this is like the hall of fame of, you're in the line, the lineage of Jesus. And these people were messed up. And that's comforting to me, right? Because you're messed up. I mean, I'm messed up. And we need to know that that's okay. And that's what Jesus came for, is to save us from us. And like I said, I've never been more excited to talk about genealogy this morning. That's what we're going to do. Starting in verse 1 of Matthew chapter 1. And I'm going to kind of cruise through this. I can't pronounce all the words properly, I'm sure. Just go with it. If I butcher it and you know how you really pronounce it, tell me later. I'm not interested. I'm just kidding. So in verse 1, it says, "This is a record of the ancestors of Jesus, the Messiah, a descendant of David and of Abraham." And before we get into this, like, I don't know that we put a great deal of emphasis on our genealogy. Like, I mean, you know, sure, it's important who your parents are and maybe your grandparents, and maybe you go back just a little bit further than that. But we kind of stop there. Most people don't, you know, track it for generations and generations and generations. But it was really important in their day, kind of the genealogy and where you're from, and even all the way back to, like, what tribe of Israel you were from, because there were different tribes. And so genealogy was really important to them. All of that to say, Abraham was the father of Isaac. Isaac was the father of Jacob. Jacob was the father of Judah and his brothers. Judah was the father of Perez and Zerah. Zerah. Your guess is as good as mine. Whose mother, this is the important part. And it's funny, like every time things are in kind of, what are those parentheses? Yeah. Whose mother was Tamar in parentheses, because that's a really important detail. Perez was the father of Hezron. Hezron was the father of Ram. Ram was the father of Amminadab. Amminadab was the father of Nahshon. Nahshon was the father of Salmon, or Salmon, if you're from East Texas. Salmon was the father of Boaz, parentheses, whose mother was Rahab. That one, we're going to get into that, but that one is probably the coolest one of all of them to me, whose mother was Rahab. Boaz was the father of Obed, whose mother was Ruth, in parentheses again. Ruth is really important. She's got her own book in the Bible. Killed it. Obed was the father of Jesse. Jesse was the father of King David. David was the father of Solomon. This one's kind of funny. Whose mother was Bathsheba, the widow of Uriah. And if you know anything, we'll talk about the story in a minute. I'm sure David, if he could kind of like fast forward to the time that they were writing this, they're like, can't you leave that little detail out? Right? Like, you know, biggest mistake of my life. Thanks for reminding me. Right? And I think that's important. I'll get there. Solomon was the father of Rehoboam. Rehoboam was the father of Abijah. Abijah was the father of Asa. Asa was the father of Jehoshaphat. And if you're pregnant or expecting, I dare you to name your kid Jehoshaphat. Jehoshaphat was the father of Jehoram. Jehoram was the father of Uzziah. Uzziah was the father of Jotham. Jotham was the father of Ahaz. Ahaz was the father of Hezekiah. You guys are interested, right? This is good. Hezekiah was the father of Manasseh. Manasseh was the father of Amon. Amon was the father of Josiah. Josiah was the father of Jehoiakim and his brothers. I'm almost positive that's how you pronounce that one. That's good. Born at the time of the exile to Babylon. So Jehoiakim and his brothers were born at the time of the exile to Babylon. All really important historical, you know, events and things. After the Babylonian exile, Jehoiakim was the father of Shealtiel. Shealtiel was the father of Zerubbabel. Zerubbabel was the father of Abiud. Abiud was the father of Eliakim. I mean, what do? You just go with it, man. You just go with it. Eliakim was the father of Azor. Azor was the father of Zadok. Zadok was the father of Akim. Akim was the father of Eliud. Eliud was the father of Eleazar. Eleazar was the father of Mathan. Mathan was the father of Jacob. Jacob was the father of Joseph, the husband of Mary. Thank God for simple names, right? Jacob was the father of Joseph, the husband of Mary. Mary gave birth to Jesus, who is called the Messiah. We're done. Let's go home. That was enough, right? But what I want to talk about, we're just going to pull a few of these people out, kind of down the line. People that are in the line, the lineage, the genealogy of Jesus, and their lives, and their circumstances, and their failures. And they still kind of made the cut, so to speak. And it's important because I think that if more than anything, this season should remind us that Jesus didn't come for those who are well. Like Jesus came for those who are sick. Jesus didn't come for those who didn't need hope. He came for those who needed hope. And I think that would categorize all of us. And if you don't think you're well, or if you don't think you're sick, right? I mean, we've all got this condition, this sin problem, and Jesus remedied that by coming to the earth. So let's start with a guy named Jacob. Jacob, it was the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob, right? And so anytime in the Old Testament, or a lot of times in the Old Testament, that's how God is referenced as, that's the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. And what's interesting about Jacob is that he was kind of shady. Like when you're named, your nickname is heel grabber and deceiver, you're kind of shady, right? That's a pretty dicey or indicator of your dicey character. Like you're kind of just a, and you ever met people that are shady? I'll tell you exactly how you tell if somebody's shady. They got shifty eyes, man. Just, if you see somebody with shifty eyes, they're shady. Just hold on to your wallet, anything that's important, right? Shifty, shady. And Jacob was, that was his nickname, was the deceiver, the heel grabber. And he had a brother named Esau. As a matter of fact, it was so bad that he tricked his brother Esau. We've talked about this before. It's a really interesting story, and kind of the implications are really important. But he tricked his brother Esau into giving him his birthright for a bowl of stew. And that may not sound like a big deal to you, but that was huge back then. The firstborn got the lion's share of the inheritance from the father. And so basically Jacob flip-flopped, you know, he would get more than Esau. And the line of Jesus, it very well could have been, if Jacob didn't deceive Esau, it would be the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Esau. But it's the God of Jacob, because Jacob tricked Esau. And this is what he did. So he tricked Esau, was out hunting. He came in, he's like, man, I'm famished, I'm hungry. Jacob's like, I've got some stew. He's like, I'll give you my stew if you give me your birthright, which is a terrible deal, right? Like, I mean, that's the deal you make with a three-year-old. Like, you trick him into giving him something you really want with something that's, like, valueless, right? Terrible deal. And so, at any rate, Jacob agreed to it, Esau agreed to it, but he still had to get it kind of approved by his father, and his father still had to bless him. So this is what Jacob did. Genius. Esau was hairy. Jacob was smooth, right? Didn't have much hair. So Jacob went and like got animal hair and put it all over his arms. I don't know. I don't think they had super glue back in the gap, but however he got it to stay, he got it to stay. And so when he went in to get his father Jacob to bless, or I'm sorry, his father Isaac to bless him, Isaac's eyes were kind of bad. And so he felt his arms and he's like, it sounds like Jacob, but it feels like Esau. He tricked his dad by putting hair on his arms that wasn't even his own, which is just awesome. A deceptive individual, and like he's important in the whole lineage of Jesus. And it's this guy with issues, it's this guy with problems, it's this guy with a sinful nature, and he's in the lineage of Jesus. It was an interesting situation, and he concocted this awesome plan to pull it all off. I mean, dicey. Don't do that, right? And then you kind of go down a little bit further. One of the ones that got put in the parentheses was Tamar. It says, Judah was the father of Perez and Zerah, whose mother was Tamar. And this is another one of those that, if you read it today, you're just like, wow, right? Kind of weird. So I'll give you the backstory with Tamar. Tamar was actually married to Judah's son. And everybody say, gross. Or you should, because you get what's going on here. Judah had two sons. One was named that's not a mistake, E-R. And the second one was named Onan, like the barbarian. And what had happened was that Tamar married who was Judah's son, right? You following? So she married died because apparently he was a bad guy and God killed him. Aren't you glad things don't work quite like that anymore? I hope. Thank God for Jesus. This is another reason to thank God for Jesus, right? Dead. And so anyway, God took because he was a terrible dude. So the custom at the time was that the next in line, the next brother, like the youngest brother of the dude, would marry the dude's wife. A lot of dudes and marrying brothers, and that's just, you know, weird things. Like today, you're just like, no, I'm good, right? Just go on about your business. But that's the custom, and that's the way they did things. And so died. Tamar marries Onan. Onan isn't much better than and he dies as well. And so Judah now has one more son. And he's younger, so he tells Tamar, wait on my youngest son, wait till he gets older, and then I'll give him to you to marry so that the line can continue. Because, again, having children, especially boys, to carry on the family name was really, really, really important at the time and in the day. And I think, you know, it's pretty important today too. Everybody, every dude I know wants a boy. Give me a boy, right? And girls, and they just steal everything from you like your heart. Where are we going here, people? Where are we going? So all of that to say, Judah went back on his word. He didn't give Tamar his youngest son because he was like, at this point, he kind of thought, Tamar, like, you messed up. Like, both my sons have died, and you're the common denominator. So why would I give my baby boy to you so that the same result would happen to him? So he went back on his word. He didn't give Tamar his youngest son. I don't even know what his name is. I'd probably butcher it, too. But that was kind of the circumstances that she was in. And so what she did is there's a lot of deception and trickeration going on in the Old Testament. She went, she knew that Judah was going to shear sheep in some place that I can't pronounce, and it was like he's going on a business trip, right? He's got things to do, business to take care of. So he goes on this trip, and she goes before him to this town that she's going to, or that she knows that he's going to, and she dresses up like a prostitute, covers her face, and Judah apparently didn't have the highest quality of character. So he's like, hey, or however you would holler, you know, at a girl back in the day in whatever language they spoke, right? I think, hey, is kind of universal, right? Like, what's up, girl? At any rate, so this is kind of what happened. So Judah goes into this prostitute who happens to be Tamar, but he doesn't know that, which is just funny to me. Can you not, do your eyes not working? Must have been dark. That's all I know, right? And he didn't have money to pay for the services. And so what he did is he's like, here's the deal. I'll have some money when I'm on my way back through. Hold my staff until I come back through. He comes back through, and he's like, hey, where's the prostitute? I got to pay her. And they're like, we don't know what you're talking about. There's not a prostitute around here. So at this point, he's like, whatever. You know, lost my staff. No big deal. So he goes back to his hometown, and Tamar had already gone back. Tamar is pregnant. He got her pregnant. This is like the 50 Shades of Genesis, right? Better than any soap opera you guys have seen lately, right? And so Tamar is now pregnant by Judah. And of course, the custom is that you get pregnant outside of marriage. It's an adulteration situation, and you're dead. Like, they're going to stone her. So Tamar is pregnant. Judah's like, kill her. And she sends him his staff, which is just awesome. I mean, the whole it's a terrible set of circumstances, but there's a lot of humor, I guess, to be found in it. So she sends him his staff and said, I'm pregnant by the person that owns this staff. And this is like one of this is like a Jerry Springer moment, right? So Judah's like, oh, Lord, it's me. You know, like, that's my baby daddy. And so just crazy, crazy stuff. All of this is going on, and both of these people end up in the lineage and the line of Jesus. That gives me hope, because, like, I'm not that messed up. Like, I'm messed up, but I'm not that messed up, right? Neither are you, I hope. Like, 50 Shades of Genesis, I thought that was just clever. That was fantastic. And so it was just really cool to me that she made the cut. Like, this person who was obviously very deceptive, and these crazy circumstances and things that went on, and these sins that led to the circumstances, all of that didn't exempt them from the lineage of Jesus. And then there was another one that was Rahab. And I thought this one was really cool. It's another one in the parentheses that, you know, just happens to go like that. Salmon was the father of Boaz, whose mother was Rahab. And so it's interesting when you look at kind of I didn't even know this was the same person, but you guys remember the story in the Old Testament. How many of you guys went to VBS as a kid? Vacation Bible School. And so probably at some point through all of that, you heard the story about they were going into the promised land, so they sent out spies. They sent out 12 spies to look at the land and see what it was like. And so when they sent out the spies, they went to a town called Jericho. Within the walls of Jericho was a lady named Rahab. It's just funny that she, too, was a prostitute. I don't know what's up with all these prostitutes in the Old Testament. Like, we just came out of a series called A Prophet and a Prostitute, where Gomer married Hosea, or Hosea married Gomer, who was a prostitute. Just crazy stuff. So, Rahab was a prostitute in the city of Jericho. She was an outsider. She wasn't Jewish. And if you look at kind of the context, like, that's a big deal. And I think there's a lot to be said about that we'll kind of hit in a minute. And so Joshua sent out the spies, and they kind of came back, and, you know, they gave the report that they did. But while they were there, the men of the city found out that they were spies. And obviously, you know, espionage is kind of a big deal. Like, if you're a spy against America, like, we're like, kill them, right? I mean, not us, but the government. It's just a big deal. Like, you don't betray your people. And so they found out there were spies there, and so they were looking for them. And Rahab took them into her home and buried them under some flax on their roof, which is just kind of, you know, the material that they would use. So she put them on the roof, covered them up with flax so nobody could find them. She hid them, and they kind of struck a deal. They're like, if you hide us, when we come to destroy this city, you and your family will be saved. And so, of course, all of that went down. The children of Israel came to Jericho. You know, they marched around the walls, right? 13 times, not seven. Read, do math, simple enough. And so all of that happened, but Rahab was saved. She and her family was saved. And I just kind of thought that was the end of the story. Like, because you don't hear much else about it. And then you start reading in the New Testament, in the book of Matthew, in the genealogy of Jesus, and that name pops up, and I Googled it just to be sure that it was the same one. And it's in Wikipedia, so it's got to be right, right? No, it's confirmed. I'm just kidding. And so she made the cut. Like, she's in the lineage of Jesus, this outsider from another culture, another set of people, another group of people with another, you know, religion and different group of rules, was accepted into Jewish culture. She ended up marrying a guy named Salmon, who's the father of Boaz, which is just really interesting because Boaz is the father of Obed, who's the father of Jesse, who's the father of David. Like, this outsider, this prostitute, is accepted into the line and lineage of Jesus in spite of everything that's gone wrong in her life, in spite of everything that she's done, in spite of her conditions, and the fact that she's an outsider. And I think that one is huge, because how many times do people feel like outsiders, especially with respect to religion and Jesus and church? People feel like they don't belong, but you do. And that's what the story of Jesus is about. And so, kind of moving right along in the line here, the genealogy, let's move on to David. And David is, he always gets a really good rap until you talk about that one thing, right? That one mistake, that one, see what had happened was, right? And that's David's life. Like, it seems like everything about his life was on the up and up, and he did the right thing. And he's even called a man after God's own heart. Like, how would you like to be described if you're a dude? I mean, if you're a woman, probably be insulting a little bit, I hope, right? And so he's referred to as a man after God's own heart. But it's like this one thing that haunts him forever. Even when they mention him in the genealogy, they're like, oh yeah, and David was the father of Solomon, but his mom was Bathsheba, who is the widow of Uriah. And if you don't know the details on that, it's crazy, the circumstances. Uriah was married to Bathsheba. David sent Uriah, he was in the army, sent him off. And while he was off at war, David saw Bathsheba taking a bath, and he's like, sup? And he's the king, so obviously he can do whatever he want to do. He calls for Bathsheba. She gets pregnant. Like, there's just, I'm telling you, dude, somebody needs to forget 50 Shades of Grey, write 50 Shades of the Old Testament. You can get paid. Somebody going, if you get rich, don't forget about us, right? And so David takes Bathsheba, she gets pregnant, and then Uriah comes back. So once he finds out that Bathsheba's pregnant, he's trying to think of a way to take all of the responsibility and the blame and pass it off on somebody else. He's like, okay, I'm going to get Uriah to come back, and I'm going to get him to go sleep with his wife so that nobody will even think that it's me. It's just like, oh, she's pregnant, had to be her husband. Great plan, right? But Uriah was such a good guy that, like, he wouldn't even go home to be with his wife when all of his brothers were at war. Like, what a dude. I thought it was pretty cool. I don't know. Do you guys ever see the movie Pearl Harbor? Sucks. Like, Uriah is the opposite of that. Like, I don't know. I hated that movie. And I don't know where that came from or what the point was, but it's good. Just go with it, right? And so Uriah was such an honorable guy. He wouldn't even go and take the comfort of his home and be with his wife when he knew that all of the people that he loved and cared about were all fighting a war. And so David's like, well, this isn't going to work. So he gets Uriah drunk. He's like, surely if he's drunk, like, he'll go. He's like, you know, pretty woman. Oh, you're my wife. Even better. Plus, win-win, bonus. Then she would get pregnant, even though she's already pregnant, and all of the blame and responsibility will be off on me. But Uriah, even in that condition, was still more honorable, obviously, than David was, and he didn't do what David wanted him to do. And so David, he's like, the final solution was to send Uriah out on the front lines of the battlefield to die. And that's what happened. So this detail comes up kind of when they're talking about Jesus or the line of Jesus. David, whose son was Solomon, whose mother was Bathsheba, who was the widow of Uriah. And it's just, it's crazy for me to think about, like, all of the failures that these people had and the way that we revere them. These are like legends of the faith and like heroes of Christianity. And man, they had some problems. And it's comforting to me because we've got some problems. And it's just a constant reminder of the story of Jesus and the power of it and why he came and did what he did. The last one that we're going to look at is Solomon, who was David's son. And when we talk about Solomon, all we typically talk about is like Solomon was the wisest man that ever lived. Solomon was jacked up. Like if you read like, I think if you read just the Proverbs, you're like, oh yeah, Solomon rocks. You read Ecclesiastes, you're like, this guy's crazy. He was the guy that had everything but still felt no meaning and no purpose. And he had tried everything to find happiness. And he had pursued love and meaning and purpose and all these other avenues. And he didn't find it because it's not there. It's only in our spirituality, our relationship with God and Jesus. And Solomon, this is the guy, like I said, he had everything. It says that he was the wealthiest man that ever lived. He was also the wisest man that ever lived. And even in spite of that, it says in Ecclesiastes chapter 2, verses 10 and 11, it says, I denied myself nothing my eyes desired. I refused my heart no pleasure. My heart took delight in all my labor, and this was the reward for all my toil. Yet, when I surveyed all that my hands had done and what I had toiled to achieve, everything was meaningless. Like, this guy had everything. He built buildings, and he had temples, and he had apparently, you know, you always hear when they're talking about the, do you guys watch conspiracy theory things? Stop. Just stop. But when they talk about the Knights Templar, and it's Solomon's treasure, and they're talking about, they still talk about the things that this guy had today. He said he looked at all of that, and everything was meaningless. There was no point in it. It was chasing after the wind, and nothing was gained under the sun. And I think it's just a really good story for us. The moral of this story is that, man, the purpose isn't found in anything. It's not found in possessions, and it's not found in, especially, thank God that somebody says this at Christmas time. Hello. It's not found in material things. And we get it messed up sometimes. And so I think it's just important that we see that. And Solomon was such a great indicator of that. And this is the guy that we don't think about this either. Solomon apparently got bored really easy. He had 700 wives and 300 concubines, or vice versa. I'm like, dude, I can't even handle one wife. I don't know, right? Ain't true? Just waiting for the head nod, right? And so this is the guy that ultimately was led away from the God of his fathers by all of his wives. It says in 1 Kings chapter 11, verse 4, it says his wives turned his heart after other gods. And it subsequently caused a civil war. It divided the kingdom of Israel into two different kind of sections, the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom, the kingdom of Israel and the kingdom of Judah. And so like this guy, although we revere him and he was, you know, the wisest man that ever lived, and we look at the book of Proverbs and we're like, yes, yeah, Solomon's awesome. He was messed up. He had problems. He caused problems. Like, he, you know, idle hands are the enemy's playground. Like, that was Solomon's life. Like, when he didn't have anything to do, he found something to do, and he usually made things worse. Like, and so he pursued all of these things to find contentment. He pursued all of these things to find joy and meaning and purpose, and he didn't find it. And this guy is in the line, the lineage of Jesus, and I just think there's a story in there for us. Like, because we do that. Like, we pursue other things to find meaning. We pursue other things to find purpose. We pursue other things, and we use other things. And all you're doing, this is what you're doing when you do that. Like, when you use, you know, drugs or sex or alcohol or whatever you use to mask your pain or try to find comfort or whatever you do, you're just putting a Band-Aid on a gaping wound. Like, you need stitches. You need surgery. You don't need a Band-Aid. You need Jesus. You need the great physician. And that's what he said he came to do. He didn't come for those who are well. He came for those who are sick. And that's us. And that's what the story of Jesus is about. That's what the Christmas story is about. He came to give us hope. And you can find that hope in whatever circumstance you come from. That's what is so beautiful, like the diversity in these people's stories. You find cheaters. You find liars, you find deceivers, you find heel grabbers, you find outsiders, you find murderers, you find adulterers, you find people who are looking for hope and meaning and purpose in all the wrong places. And Jesus came for them, just like he came for us. And that's what the Christmas story is. That's what the birth of Christ is about. It's the beginning of hope for us, that because God came in the form of a man and was a baby and all of the humble circumstances that he came in, we now have hope. Isn't that good? And it's he came for sinners, like just simply put. And I love the way that Paul addressed this, because I don't know, maybe you have, I think we can go one of two ways with this. You can either be one of those that kind of defers, or you're one of those that's overly critical of yourself. Like some people are like, oh, he's so much worse than I am. Anybody like that? And then if I'm kind of the other way, I'm like, I'm hypercritical, and I feel like just the worst person in the world sometimes. And Paul, I think, was kind of like that. He's like, Christ died for sinners, of which I am chief. Like, I'm the worst of the worst, man. I know what I've done wrong, and I know all of my shortcomings and all my failures and all my sin, and Christ died for me. And that doesn't happen unless he was born, right? That's the significance of the Christmas season.